Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. This first hour is going to be very maple-y. You won't even believe the stuff you're going to hear about as we learn about maple equipment from several centuries ago. And at 10, we get to hang with the logger as Rusty stops in to talk about his upcoming Waterbury shows. And we'll finish by learning about a fire and rescue squad run by college students. But first, let's head to Chelsea. About a month ago, I made the silly mistake thinking we could talk about a 25-foot wind harp and an amazing collection of maple memorabilia in a half-hour segment. We took that time just to talk about the wind harp alone. So I've invited Hal Mattoon back for a full hour to discuss all aspects of maple sugaring and his incredible collection. Hal is the author of Maple Spout Spiles and Taps and also Maple Spout Spiles, Taps and Tools. And he joins us now. Hal, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Great to have you back. Listeners, if you'd like to ask Hal a sugaring question or one about his collection, you can call us at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Hal, do you remember the first time you ever sugared?
Yes, I can. And I was probably more of a nuisance than I was help. It was back in the early 40s.
Wow. Yeah, what jobs were you allowed to do at that time?
Well, I was allowed to go with my father and my uncle into the sugar woods, and I had a small pail, and I was helping get to the sap with a team of horses.
Oh, my.
So that was my first experience. And then through the years, I learned how to do other things, like helping getting the wood in to fire the evaporator and learning more and more aspects in relation to the maple sugaring process.
At what point, Hal, did they say, okay, you've learned, you know, you've had your learner's permit, it's time for you to boil?
I was 15. And that was my first time, and I was some nervous, but yeah. Things went very well.
Oh, did they?
I had a good teacher.
Oh, that's great. What kind of team of horses did you use back then to go into the woods and get the sap?
We had that particular time, the male horse was Dick, and the female was Dolly, and she was gray, and Dick was a bay horse. And it's hard to say what their breed lines were because it could have been a mixture.
Yeah.
As to fearing, a purebred like a Morgan or a Percheron.
Yeah.
But these were probably more Belgian.
Yeah, that's
than anything.
Yeah. Now, did you take to the whole process pretty quickly? I mean, to be able to boil by 15 seems to me like you did. But, you know, from the time you were, you know, just collecting in your pail some of the sap, you know, how quickly did you kind of get into sugaring?
Oh, more so in later years. I was kind of to give my dad a rest or for a little while. That's when I did the boiling. Then in later years, when I was in my 20s, I was able to operate the whole thing by myself.
And did it ever feel like a chore for you, or was this always, you know, something you enjoyed right from the start?
I always enjoyed it.
Yeah.
I enjoyed all the aspects of maple sugaring, but I do have a favorite, and that was gathering the sap.
Yeah.
With sap buckets, because our sugar maple trees make me think of dairy cows. Because some trees will run more sap than others, and some trees have a higher sugar content when you test the sap than others. And it's the same thing with the dairy cow. Some produce more milk than others, and some have a higher butterfat test than others.
Yeah. And you had a dairy farm there in Chelsea for years.
Very, very closely related in those two aspects.
Yeah, I've never heard anybody else make that parallel, but the comparisons, are right there. I absolutely see it. So you're going to throw out a number. How many seasons of sugaring do you think that you've done in your life now?
All 75.
Wow. Oh, my gosh.
From my childhood.
Yeah, sure. Now. They all count. Wow. Yeah. And Hale, are there any seasons that really have stood out as being just absolutely amazing?
Yes. That's a good question. 1961. I gathered sap because my dad was doing most of the boiling then, and I was on the sap crew. There was two of us gathering, and I had another elderly gentleman that was excellent with the horses. We had two teams of horses going. And that year, we had 3,500 taps. We made 1,760 gallons of syrup, and we burnt 75 cords of wood. And it was just absolutely phenomenal that year.
You know these numbers. Have you kept a log of this through the years like that?
Yes, in my head. Because that was an outstanding year. But also, we used to keep a record on one of the doors in the sugar house of the day that we tapped and the last day of boiling, and whether it was a good season and the sugar content was high or low average for the year, and little notes like that.
Boy, I'm thinking 1961, at that time, John F. Kennedy had just taken the White House, and later that year, Roger Maris breaks Babe Ruth's home run record. And in Chelsea, Vermont, Hale Mattoon has a record year of sugaring. What a great year, right?
Absolutely.
So memorable. Wow.
Yeah.
Well, you mentioned keeping those kind of records and knowing, what has happened all through 75 years of sugaring. So how has sugaring changed in your lifetime?
Oh, I'd still do it pretty much the old-fashioned way. Mm-hmm. But technology has really taken over into the large sugar makers where in my early years, if you had tapped 1,000 trees, that was a good number. If you had 2,000 or more, that was quite an operation because the sap had to be gathered, whereas now today we have the modern plastic pipelines.
Mm-hmm.
Which it's a directly from the tree to the sugar house, no gathering required. Also, they're boiling with oil and some places steam. So that's certainly a big factor because no one is required to have to fire the arch or get the wood in.
Mm-hmm.
And the reverse osmosis,
right,
that is now. You can increase the sugar content of the sap before it goes into the evaporator. In some instances, when you're going from 2.5% sugar and you're going up to 20 to, I've heard some reports of close to 30% sugar before it hits the boiling pans.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a tremendous savings on time.
Yep.
And labor.
And to get syrup to the right consistency, it's about 66.7% sugar. So consider, starting at either 2% sugar or 20 to 30% sugar certainly cuts down that time of boiling.
Oh, dramatically, yes.
Boy, I'm really proud of myself, Hale. 19 years ago, I wouldn't have known what we were talking about when I first moved to Vermont. And today I feel just a tad smarter about sugaring.
That makes me think of a little poem that was written many years ago. In fact, it was in a Vermont agricultural bulletin. an article about maple sugaring, and it was a poem that said that the and it was written by John Sachs. He was a famous poet, and he said that one time that Vermont was famous for four things. And I'd like to quote that, if I may. That
you may, poem. Please.
Okay. It starts out, men, women, maple sugar, and horses. The first are strong, the latter fleet. The second and third are exceedingly sweet. And all are uncommonly hard to beat.
That's beautiful.
I always thought that was... I used to hear my grandmother recite that.
Boy, that should be like the state motto, I think. That is beautiful. So how was your season this year? How many trees did you tap?
I tapped 300.
All right.
Still use the sap buckets and fire with wood. The old-fashioned way, as I said, except I don't have the team of horses. I have a 1958 John Deere two-cylinder tractor that I gather the sap with.
Perfect.
I'm still using the same gathering tank that my dad and I bought in 1956.
Wow.
And it looks still very good. Mm-hmm. And I would say over 90% of our syrup that we made was fancy grade, which is a new grade A light amber. And then now it's the delicious, delicate taste as it's. You have to put the label on the container that
right.
If you sell the syrup.
Yeah. I'm speaking with Hale Mattoon.
No, overall, it was a good year for
good
us.
Year.
It wasn't a record year, but it was a good year.
Excellent. Hale, let's talk about that collection. What is it about the equipment of sugaring that you find so interesting that got you started collecting these items?
Yes, that's... I really started seriously collecting maple sap spouts in 1971 because the spouts that we were using when we were tapping many trees then. There's one particular spout when we used to wash the spouts individually before we tapped with a little percolator brush. That was before the sap spout brush came out. And this particular spout, I always look for it when we were washing the spouts. And in 71, I says, I'm going to take this spout out and set it aside. That's the only one we have like it. Mm. And so I did, and I got to thinking, you know, after sugaring, boy, that poor spout looks lonely. So then I started taking some of the other spouts that we used that were different by different manufacturers, and also even though they're the same spout, the same manufacturer could have a variation in the spouts. So one thing led to another, and it just grew, and I kept finding more at garage sales and flea markets, and it just grew and grew. So that was my primary interest in getting started and collecting maple equipment.
What was that original lonely spout that you put aside?
It was patented in 1905 by James Warner of Essex. And he also made many other spouts from different patents. But this particular one had it in an enclosed trough. In other words, the exit end of the spout all the way back to the eye on it that's made to hook a cover to if you use that type of cover. Mm-hmm. But it was all enclosed where most all the other spouts that we had were open trough partway on the top part of the spout. So that was a special spout for me. So that's my first one.
How many spouts do you have now in your collection?
Hundreds. I don't dare to say, but about 3 years ago, I did count them up, and I had over 700.
Oh my goodness!
Of wood spouts and formed sheet metal and cast spouts.
So, in your entire collection, how many items would you say, this is beyond spouts, everything else you have, your maple sugaring equipment collection, how many pieces would you say you have in it?
Oh, hundreds.
Well, you've got 700 spouts alone.
Yeah, you know, I have different sap buckets, different covers.
Yeah. You have the cans.
Maple syrup cans.
Yep.
I don't know, it's probably between 200 and 300 of those.
Mm-hmm.
And different syrup pans that were made in early stages. Some after a boiling pan, mm-hmm. a flat boiling pan, and there was also sugar, what they call sugaring off pans, that you could make your maple sugar in, and those were, oh gosh, back in probably late 1800s up to early 1900s. I probably have 10 or a dozen of those. And also my wife has, she collects maple sugaring molds and glass containers and maple sugaring pitchers, and also a postcard collection that she has. So,
Well, it's good to hear that Diane has contributed to part of the collection, because I was a little worried. I was going to ask you if she was okay with you keeping all of this, but she's feeding the collection, right? So it's all okay.
Yes.
How much room, Hale, does all this take up?
Well, the small items we have in the basement of our house, and the larger items are, I used to have a wood shed that would hold 40 cord of wood at this sugar house.
Mm-hmm.
And I've closed off 75% of that wood shed, and I have the larger maple collective items in there.
Mm.
And also the arch fronts, I have those. Those are cast iron, and I have a collection of those, and those are hanging on both the outside and the inside of the sugar house.
Incredible. So, all right, let's take a call, Hale. We've got Cody joining us from Randolph. Hi, Cody. Go right ahead.
Hello, sir. How are you this morning?
I'm fine, thank you. And how are you?
Good. I wanted to make it over to see you this spring. I didn't make it there, but I just wanted to call in and say, you know, thanks for all your work and preserving the history of sugaring and for helping me when I first started getting going when I was a youngster. And, I don't want to keep your time because I want everybody to hear all your valuable history about sugaring. But glad to hear you had a good season.
Well, and did you have a good season?
Yes, we had a wonderful season this year.
Good. I think you made the first start that was made this year. It was very early.
Yeah, myself and a few other producers in Vermont tapped some trees in early December, and I would have boiled in December, but I was waiting on a part for my evaporator, so we ended up boiling January 3rd.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, that's the new year.
That's right.
Well, thank you, Cody.
All right.
Thanks for calling.
I also want to let you know, on the 21st of May, the Orange County Sugar Makers are having their spring meeting at my sugar house, and it'd be great if you could make it over the hill to visit for a minute.
Absolutely. I will be there.
Cody, right, what's your sugar house?
We're CDA Maple in Randolph Center.
All right. Thanks very much for calling in.
Yep. Thank you.
Hale, that is great to hear. I'm wondering how the Hale Mattoon family tree, you know, the people you have touched through the years, you have helped learn how to boil, just like, you know, your father taught you. How many do you think you've trained and taught and kind of nurtured to become sugar makers?
Oh, my goodness. through the collecting, many. And the wonderful thing about collecting is the wonderful folks that you meet when doing this great hobby.
What are some of the oldest pieces you have in your collection?
probably the oldest I have that I'm thinking right off the top of my head is the Sheldon and Chase sap spout. They called it a sap spout, but it was like a trough to convey the sap from the sugar woods to the sugar house, which was like today's modern plastic pipeline.
Mm.
And that was 1863 that was patented by Sheldon and Chase in Calais. And it's amazing how it was set up, because each length was made by suitable tools or machinery.
Mm-hmm.
And it was made from a single piece of wood, and they were about 10 feet long. And they're camphored in a way so that the one piece that you set, that the next piece you get would be different on the end, so you'd have to switch ends to make sure it matched the first piece you put down.
Mm-hmm.
And this line was set up by driving stakes in the woods and having this line run all the way to the sugar house, as I mentioned previously. And there was a portable hopper that you could set over the trough to dump your sap into. So there was no need to have roads for the horses, and also a gathering tank. So the sap went right directly to the sugar house, and they patented it as a sap spout.
Mm.
And it's pretty unique. I have a couple pieces of that in my collection, and I think it's probably about the oldest that I can think of.
That's pretty modern for
getting back in 1863. Yeah.
What a really innovative, idea that long ago. Like to shake the hand of the engineer who came up with that to try to make things a little easier back in the mid-1800s. And we're talking that would have been Civil War era right there.
Yeah,
all right.
Absolutely.
How about
yes.
that? I've got Hale Mattoon with me all hour to talk about a subject he's just mildly interested in. Maple sap syrup, taps, spiles, spouts, boiling, bottling, oh yeah, and pouring over pancakes. We're going to take a break. I hope Deborah from Essex can hold on. We'll get to you right after the break. CBS News update, and listeners, you can hop on the line as well. 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255 to chat with Hale. And coming up today at 12:35, Sox and Jays wrap up their series. First pitch from Fenway on WDEV is 1:35. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
In decades past, you opened a business, hung out your shingle, and the customers came. Today, hanging out your shingle means creating an engaging website. The modern consumer is using the internet to find businesses like yours. Are you positioned so you'll rise to the top of their search? Let the Radio Vermont Group Digital Services work with you to make sure you're visible online and to target your marketing to location, demographic, and interest. Learn more at rvgdigital.com.
We're back on Vermont Viewpoint. I'm pretty sure Hale Mattoon can't imagine life without sugaring. And I'm confident the trees in his sugar bush can't imagine a march without Hale Mattoon. He's with us this hour sharing sugaring tales, taps, and tools. And listeners, to ask Hale about sugaring or about his incredible collection of sugaring stuff, you can call us at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. Let's head back to the phones. We've got Deborah joining us from Essex. Good morning, Deborah.
Hi, good morning.
Go right ahead.
Years ago, probably 30 or more years ago, I used to help with a farmer in Middlebury where I grew up farming, sugaring, and he used a team of horses too. And so he had a gelding and a mare. The gelding was the one who did the steering, apparently, because he lost sight in one eye. And then he lost sight in the other eye, and they would still go out with them. But when they're in the woods, they wouldn't drive the horses in the woods. Probably you didn't drive yours either when you were in the woods. They just knew the roads. Although when Rufus lost his sight, they realized he was the one that did the steering because they kind of drift off to the side and someone would have to holler over at him to gee over to make Lena move over so they'd stay on the road.
Oh, my. Deborah, that's a great story. Thanks for sharing that. Hell, what was it like for the horses, you know, once they got into the woods and would be pulling the sled and getting the sap?
Oh, it was just wonderful working with horses. A good team of horses, as the lady said, you could just speak to them and tell them to gee or ha. Mm-hmm. And that's left or right, and you know, and get up and haul to start and stop, and it's just like having another person doing in the woods.
Mm. How much could they pull? How much sap could they pull?
Yeah, that other person could be gathering staff instead of having to drive the horses.
Yeah.
But when we did it, we had the two teams. The elderly gentleman that I spoke of that was excellent with the horses,
yeah.
He would drive. He'd come back into the woods with the empty tank and the horses, and he would take the full one and go to Sugar House. And while he was gone, we would be filling that one.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way it would go all day when we were gathering.
Wow.
And it worked very well. And we had one particular horse that if you said, whoa, and there was a sap bucket nearby, and he happened to be thirsty, he would take that extra step, and he'd take his nose, and he would bump the cover with his nose, and the cover would fly off the bucket, and mm-hmm. then he'd have a drink of sap.
I love it. That is one. That is a real sugaring horse right there.
As I say, with a good team of horses, it's just wonderful.
Yeah.
Now, sometimes you have one horse that doesn't mind too well at first, and mm-hmm. but if you've got a good horse with him, he learns the habit.
Love it. Hale, now, I want you to be as nice as possible to me. I'm a city boy, and I still pronounce syrup like a Flatlander, but what is the difference between a spout and a tap?
That's a good question.
Oh, okay.
The terminology of the items to convey the sap from the tree to a vessel or a bucket or another container or, and nowadays, the modern pipeline has changed over the years. And many of them have been used interchangeably, but historically they meant different things. Now, take like a spile. A spile is actually a peg or a plug made of wood. But that spile could be converted to a spout if a hole is drilled in the center lengthwise, starting on either end and drilling it lengthwise. Then it could become a spout. Because it could convey the sap then from the tree to the container.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, a spile is made of wood, and it was made to plug a hole, and I think it might relate back to the old wooden barrels. And also, if you had a leaky hole in a boat or a ship, you could also plug it
with a spile.
Hmm. But once you put a hole in it, it becomes a spout.
Do you have any of those in your collection, a spile that has become a spout?
Yes, I do. And it's also a tap is also a stopper or a plug, but it could be made of another material. Now, we refer to, you know, it's just a common everyday sugaring talk. Well, have you tapped your trees yet?
Mm-hmm.
Or how many are you going to tap this year? And actually, as I say, it's a stopper or a plug, but this is the term strike lightly is to tap. And that's very important to tap the spout when you're driving it into the tree.
Right.
Because if you drive it too hard, it causes a crack in that, either above or below the spout, or even both ways if it's driven too hard, and the sap will leak out that crack. So you do tap them lightly.
Gotcha.
To get them properly seated and not do any damage. But so that's how some of these terms or terminology of words have got interchanged.
Yeah. Now it all seems to make such perfect sense.
They refer to the spouts as spoils.
Mm. And what do you call those little roofs that you put over the bucket?
A cover.
Oh, okay. A cover. Okay.
A cover. Yes. And there's many, many different styles and types of those.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's amazing at the different shapes and the companies that made these covers to fit their buckets.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite interesting.
It is. Now,
and of course, getting back to before the time of spiles and spouts, of course, the Native Americans, when they got the sap from the tree, they cut a diagonal gash in the tree.
Uh-huh.
And they would use a reed.
Oh, sure.
A piece of a reed from a reed grass. Which it's a grass, but it's like a straw.
Right.
In its construction, that's what like that. And also, they would use a concave piece of bark, and would have baskets that they would made out of bark.
Mm-hmm.
Where we use buckets.
Right.
To catch the sap. And I've read stories about one time about a young lad in the 1700s that got captured by the Indians. And he told about that they would make vessels as much to hold 100 gallons out of elm bark.
Wow.
From the elm tree. And another thing that he mentioned in the book was that the Indians would let the sap freeze in the tank or the vessel made of the elm bark.
Right.
And the next day they would take the ice out because the ice is the water.
Right.
That froze. So you could say the Native Americans also had the first reverse osmosis.
Absolutely.
Because they were increasing the sugar content of their sap with Mother Nature.
Oh, I love it. Let's head back to the phones, and we're heading to Brookfield this time to talk to Linda. Good morning, Linda.
Good morning, Rick. And good morning, Hale. I don't want to interrupt your wonderful stories. It's totally fascinating to listen to you.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much.
And I live relatively near to you. Just, I always say if I sneezed, I'd be in Chelsea. And I'm wondering if you welcome visitors, if you're selling syrup, et cetera, et cetera.
All right. Linda, thanks for that. Hale, what do you say? Can somebody come by and see the collection? And do you have syrup for sale?
Well, yes, we'd love to have folks, and they do. They come by to see the collection, but we're all sold out on our maple syrup.
Oh, my goodness.
So I'm sorry on that, but I feel you're more than welcome to give us a call in advance when you're coming so that we can sure and be here. But, no, because we've had guests from signed our guest book from China, Great Britain, Canada, Guatemala. So,
oh my.
And many of our states here in the United States have folks have stopped 10.
Oh, I love it. All right, Hale. So how did it happen that you became Hale Mattoon, dairy farmer, sugar maker? and to become Hale Mattoon book author?
That's a good question. Of course, it started with me. I grew up on a farm, dairy farm, and I was connected with maple sugaring, and the maple sugaring come into collecting, and of course the spout was, as I mentioned earlier, was the start and the primary of it. But it goes back to 1951 when I was in grade school here in Chelsea, and there was a gentleman that came here and taught the vocational agricultural course from up in Coventry, and associated with the course in school, there was a chapter called the FFA, the Future Farmers of America. And the gentleman, Fred Webster from Coventry, was the teacher. And even though I wasn't in his class, I used to see Fred in the hallway of the school. And whenever you stop and say, "Good morning, Mr. Webster," he always had time to stop and visit with you as to what you were doing today in school, what you did for the weekend and whatnot. But anyway, to get that, when I got into high school and I was involved with the agricultural program and the FFA, which I was involved in that for 7 years till I was 21, Fred had gone. He'd gone to Hinesburg to teach. But I used to see him at the state FFA conventions, and we'd visit. And Fred and I have stayed in contact up until his passing a year ago, this last January, and he was 99. But Fred was the factor of me doing the book, because it was about 2010, he was down here, and he saw my collection. And he looked me in the eye and he said, "Boy, you do something about this." Mm-hmm. And I was kind of shocked. Well, what do I do? He said, "This is history. Yeah. Get it documented." So that's how it came to be that I come to do the books.
Mm-hmm.
But Fred was an excellent teacher and a gentleman, and he had a tremendous agricultural collection up there in Coventry, which is very impressive.
Yeah.
So that's how I came to do the books.
I love it. Now, you have this wonderful collection, Hale. Is there someone who you'll pass it on to? Will you turn it over to a museum? How will this be preserved in perpetuity?
I hope the family is going to preserve it, and the interest is there, so I feel quite confident.
Good. All right. Take us through the collection again, and tell us about another piece that you're particularly proud of in there.
Okay. I have a pattern to make the mold to cast a maple sap spout.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
And that particular one is a fellow in Massachusetts was the one that patented it. And I can get his name here in just a second.
As you were saying mold, I thought it was just a maple sugar mold, but this is the mold for the actual tap.
To cast the sap spouts.
Wow.
And the gentleman's name was Carlton Barnett that did this. And this piece is made of brass, and that piece was made at a foundry out in Illinois, and it was sent to Cambridge, Mass, where Mr. Barnett would use that to make the molds. Because sand molds, they could cast many once they had the mold made from the pattern.
Right.
But they had to have the pattern to make the mold. It's kind of confusing, but that was the process. But it's made of brass, and it's pretty unique. So that's one of my highlight items in my collection that I'm pretty proud of.
Are you still collecting? Is there something out there that you keep thinking, man, I've got to find this thing, this particular spile or spout or cover or arch?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. There's some spouts out there that I don't have.
Mm-hmm.
But once in a while, one will come up. A vendor, you know, at flea markets or something might have one that have me look at, and sure enough, I don't have it. So it's fun of it, of doing this.
Yeah. You mentioned early on, I think it was the one that got you started, was made right here in Essex. You know, so were there a lot of manufacturers back then, and were there a number in Vermont?
Yes, there were over 20 inventors of sap spouts in Vermont, and some of those inventors had multiple patents registered with the U.S. Patent Office. One that I did several was Charles Post in Hinesburg, and he had 6 different patents related to maple sap spouts and sap buckets.
Mm.
And his first patent was in 1868, which was early, for cast spouts, because the first cast spout that we have on record was done by Homer Hecox in Rutland, New York, in September of 1860. That was cast spout. Now, the first metal spout was done by Eli Mosier in January of 1860, and he was from Flushing, Michigan. Mm. So his spout was just a piece of metal that he had formed into a shape that met his desire, and he patented it. Wow. So it's amazing how that was 1860. That you have the 2 patents that were first in sheet metal, form sheet metal, and the first in cast. But some others here in Vermont that had patents with the U.S. Patent Office, there was Archibald Leach from Highgate, Francis Lord from Reedsboro, Vermont.
Mm.
John Carrier from North Troy, Warren Tabor from Westford, and the major ones, the spouts that Bent used in my time were the Warner spout, and his first patent was in 1893, and his last one was in 1905. And the 1905 Warner spout, in my opinion, is the best cast spout ever made.
Oh, I love it. Hale, we're going to have to leave it there. This has been the most interesting hour. Thank you so much. Hale Mattoon of Chelsea is the author of Maple Spout Spiles and Taps, and also Maple Spout Spiles, Taps and Tools. Hale, it's been a pleasure, and please say hello to Diane for us.
We'll do that. And thank you.
Thank you.
I've enjoyed it.
Oh, it's been gold. We're going to take a break for news, and then we're going to come back to meet someone whose Vermont accent is almost as good as Hale's, Rusty DeWeese. And coming up tonight at 7 o'clock, some vintage Rick Norcross and Jack Donovan. Tune in to WDEV. This is Vermont Viewpoint.
We hope you're enjoying this podcast of Vermont Viewpoint with Rick Singeri. You can find podcasts of some of the other programs, including Healthcare Today and The Brady Farkas Show, on our website. In addition, we also have CBS podcasts, including Sunday Morning with Jane Pauley and 60 Minutes. For a full listing of podcasts, visit our website at WDEVradio.com.
We're back on Vermont Viewpoint. From the sugar maker, we move on to another Vermont icon, the lager. And he's come down from Elmore Mountain on the latest tour around the state with his next stop at the Grange Hall Cultural Center in Waterbury. Here in the studio with me is the logger, Rusty DeWeese. Rusty, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thanks for having me, Rick. I'm pretty much up there on one of your callers. I'm a fairly frequent
you
caller
are.
Into your show.
And you know what? We just type in Rusty.
Thank you.
It could be from anywhere. It's like, I know who Rusty is.
Like Cher.
That's right. Or Charo. Yeah, that's who I think of you more as. Also hanging out in this spacious and amazingly appointed dump studio is Monica Cowan, the founder and artistic director of the Grange Hall Cultural Center. Monica, thank you for being here as well.
My pleasure completely. Thank you.
Listeners, to ask Rusty or Monica a question or share a comment, you can call us at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Rusty, how has the tour been so far?
Yeah, you and I were talking about this, but in the last fall when I booked the tour of small town halls for winter, and in the fall everything was blowing up as far as the pandemic-y thing. So I said, I'm doing it anyway. So I did. And just as the show started in the beginning of the winter, things eased up a little bit. So been really good. Let's say Bellows Falls. I can't remember all of them. Brandon.
Bradford.
Barton. That's a lot.
Burlington.
Those are all B's. But people be coming out. And Rutland, I was in Tucky, as I like
That's
to call
right.
it, 120 people there. Bellows Falls, 220. Mm. And, it just seemed it was good timing. And as far as material and content for the Grange Hall Cultural Center shows this Saturday and Sunday, anybody that does anything knows that the more you do it, the better you get at it. So I'm at the end of the tour.
Oh,
so I'm feeling really good about the comedy and the timing and everything. It's fun, in other words, yeah.
It's been
good.
Worth it coming
it's
down from Elmore Mountain.
Yes. coming off the mountain after the pandemic, it really has been worth it, yeah.
Yeah. All right. So, Monica, why is this a show that the Grange Hall in Waterbury is excited to be hosting? And I'm assuming you're excited to be hosting it.
Of course.
But you'll say that sitting right next to Rusty anyway.
So. Put me on the spot.
Yeah.
So this is just the kind of thing that we want to be doing there, supporting local talent and having them share what they do with the community. So it's right up the alley.
And what types of events and entertainment do you try to present to the community at the hall?
Oh, gosh. You know, our motto is, as long as it's legal, you can do it here. So,
and I think he's just barely
just
legal.
Barely.
So.
Well, is that true?
No. really legal. I'm legal like weed. I'll get you high.
That's okay to say now here in Vermont.
Sure. I don't smoke, buddy. Hey, everybody, go for it.
Now, how many different Grange Halls have you played through the years, Rusty?
I think I can only specifically – that's a cool question.
Yeah.
There's one up in Milton. The Grange, so I played that Grange Hall, really mm-hmm. interesting. It looks like the Alamo kind of a, looked like Texas, it's like cinder blocky.
Yeah.
I just heard from John Bartlett, who works up there in the town, that the Grange is selling it to the town. Mm-hmm. So they're going to refurbish their Grange. So I think two Grange Halls, but it's funny you say that's just the type of thing that you and Peter are trying to do at the Grange Hall Cultural Center is, you know, put on these kind of events, and that's what the original Grange was, 1867. Mm-hmm. They were patrons of the husbandry, but they did community events, and they did they actually had political lobbies, you know, lobbies – political people come to the Granges and spout their words. So so you're doing what the old Waterbury Center Grange always did.
Well, we're staying out of politics ourselves. If somebody else wants to come and do that, they can do it. But
right, not politics.
But they were – what's really interesting, it's like –
It's spouting. You do that.
It's a great American story, actually, how the Grange Hall it was this network that built all over the nation to lobby the railroads – or lobby Washington, so the railroads wouldn't basically steal what they were putting on the trains because they were giving them nothing for their, you know, they were getting them pennies for the pennies on the dollar for their harvests and their livestock or whatever they were putting on the train, and so, you know, they were able to rally and lobby on this national level in the 18 in the late 1800s. It's pretty remarkable.
What history.
Yeah, it's really amazing. So, yeah, that's it was very political because they had to. It was going to kill off, you know, small farms.
Oh, my.
A lot of pie served in there, too.
Oh, yeah.
Over the years.
A lot of chicken, yeah. Chicken, apple.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of. Yeah, chicken pie
Bumbleberry. Now, of all the Grange halls and town halls you've played, what percentage are you allowed back into, Rusty?
Actually, that's a funny question.
But, I know it is.
But all of them. All of them. I mean, obviously, the show's rated SC, some cussing.
Right.
It's evolved from 26 years ago more of a theater piece in that I didn't break the fourth wall. It had an arc to it, and I was playing a character. But this is a lot like a conversation. I mean, I could literally do a whole show now without doing any material. So what I'll do is I'll go out there and I'll just start talking, play a couple of guitars, songs on the guitar, and see where it goes, see who's in the audience, listen. And then something will trigger me from what I'm talking about extemporaneously that will trigger me onto a set piece, material that's written. You know, boom, and it goes in there and it flows. So it's really fun for me, but I'm not so much that logging character as I used to be 10, 15, 20 years ago. So I think you don't have to, but I've just kind of changed to where my tastes, and you're older. You're 26 years older.
Yeah.
So from a performance standpoint, it's the same but different. But I'm allowed back in all of them.
That's good.
This is returning to Monica and Peter's place.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And so that means if anyone has seen you in any of the B towns throughout this tour, if they show up in Waterbury this Saturday or Sunday, they'll get a different, some the same, but some will definitely be different.
That's a good point. Because back in the day when I had that created piece and it was a staged piece, it was the same.
Right.
Same. But now it's a lot different. The kick I get out of the Grange is sitting in there. Town halls or something, those are great because those are theaters. High school auditoriums, not as much patina. But right. When you're in that Grange, it's going through my head when I'm playing that 67 Martin guitar. Mm-hmm. How many times was this fiddle tune that I'm flat picking at Saturday or Sunday show played in that Grange over the years? That same fiddle tune. Now, if you want to get really into it, the wood of the Martin guitar is reverberating in that Waterbury Center Grange, and it's the same vibrations and spiritual. If you want to get into that, it's the same thing. Everybody says the world's changing. We're divided. No. When you're at the Grange, and that E chord is being played, it's the same E chord that was played in there 150 years ago at the wedding reception of some grandkid that's going to be at the show.
Oh, wow.
That's community.
Yeah, yeah. Yep. Oh, I love it. Just to talk about community, in 1967, so I was a 7-year-old kid living just 10 miles away from where that Martin guitar was made.
Oh.
Yeah. Isn't that
incredible? So have you been to that factory?
I have not. I can't believe it. You know, sometimes you live a little too closely to something. Right. You don't realize till you go away, oh, my gosh, the rest of the world is coming to Martin, right? And you think, yeah, they make great guitars over there, but you don't.
You were 10 minutes away from there, huh?
Yeah, I lived in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, not far from Nazareth, Pennsylvania, where they are made. So give us a history and a little bit of a description of the Grange Hall here in Waterbury.
Oh, well, we bought it from the Grangers. They approached us and said, can you keep it in public use? And we were like, this is a no-brainer.
Mm-hmm.
So because we had been doing programming there. Prior to that, but we could only do so much because the wiring in there, we were afraid we would burn it down because we create theater. But we also appreciate everything else that other people do. And theater is a great sort of vessel for so many arts. You know, we want to offer that to whatever people want to do, whether it's the arts, whether it's, you know, wellness. We have a lot of wellness classes that go on in there.
Rotary dinners.
Rotary dinner.
I'm hungry
Sunday
right now.
Night. So there's, you know, it's the gamut for whatever people want to do, for whatever they need space for. There's a lot of parties that happen there. People come and do their, family parties or, you know, all sorts of different things. But we don't really limit it. So it's a place for the community to use. We there's a Crossroads Center for the Arts. It's there, which is a arts organization here in Waterbury, and that is their home. So they do a bunch of stuff.
What year was this Grange Hall built? The stumper question.
It's hard to know exactly. 1850s.
Okay.
The bell in the bell tower says 1863.
Really?
But that was put up afterwards. So, so it's been.
You're going to go out and ring that bell at about 7:15. Shows start at 7:30?
7:30, yeah.
I think, right. About 7:15, you're going to start ringing the bell to make sure people.
I'm going to go out and bang an apple core at it from outside on the street. See if I can ding it.
Talk about what's happening at the Cultural Center this Saturday and Sunday. And Monica, why don't you let people know date, time, tickets, let everybody know that info.
August 23rd and
April.
April 23rd, thank you, and April 24th, 7:30 each night. That's Saturday and Sunday coming up.
All right. How do people get tickets?
They can get tickets. If you want to use your credit card, you can go to 7daystickets.com, and we have cash and check at the door.
All right. How difficult has it been, Monica, through the pandemic, not to be able to host shows at the Grange Hall Cultural Center?
Oh, yeah. Well, like many venues, it's been a real struggle. And we are a volunteer. We don't have any staff, so we didn't qualify for any of the COVID relief. But we've been plugging along. I've taken up real estate so we can so we can keep it going. And, you know, there's all sorts of things. It gave us time to do some construction, which we are deep into. And so we're moving ahead and taking advantage of that downtime.
All right. Nice.
But it's been hard, though.
Yeah.
You know, not having people, not seeing people. So we're really excited to bring Rusty in. And that's our first show.
It is your first show.
It's our first show.
Wow. Rusty.
Coming out of COVID.
That's fabulous. Yeah. Waterbury is like your backyard growing up in Stowe, living up there on Elmore Mountain. So is this kind of a homecoming for you?
It is. It's a really, the good thing about my job is that all you have to do is be honest. And the honest bit is when I was 15 playing drums in the bands like they used to have in the VFW and everything.
Yeah, yeah.
I played with Comos, Don and Rick Como, who used to be they know Kaya, used to be related.
Yeah.
And I would pick them up on Maple Street when I was 16, four doors down. And Kellett's Bakery was there. There was a place called Kellett's Bakery,
best
very famous.
Maple. Yeah. Glazed donuts.
Monica grew
ever.
Up right there.
Oh my gosh.
And so now you're hearkening back to 1975 when I was literally on that road picking up the Comos. And then so now I've gone nowhere. Literally nowhere. And that's how many years ago. So,
it's a good place to be stuck, Rusty.
Very deep
history. It's been
history.
A great trip.
Very deep history with Maple Street. In fact, I'd love to buy a home on Maple Street right now because it's the back road into Stowe Hollow, which is where I grew up.
And I can help you with that.
Yeah, I was going to say, I have a real estate agent right here.
We'll do a little. So yeah, it is a homecoming, other than the fact that I've been to a lot of little funeral receptions and stuff at the Grange over the years. And I was in this studio first time when I was 15 on Jack Donovan's Vermont Live, bringing my drums up those back steps, playing and singing Margaritaville. So this is 1975, 85, 95, 2005, 2015. I'll show you my work. So that's 46 years I've been coming into the station doing stuff.
Oh, my goodness. Wow.
And I feel like 19, so 8 years old, so it's great.
I think we have some of the things we have in this little studio are from 46 years ago. So
yeah, and remember that theater, Monica's Theater, holds 50 people. So that's something that's very unique. You want to see theater, and I'm the presenter, you can feel the COVID droplets coming from my mouth in the front row. I mean, for 20 bucks, what else do you want?
As if this wasn't going to be a special evening.
Yeah, yeah.
That just makes it all the better.
Well, we are requiring people to wear masks no matter what their vaccination.
All right.
You are?
Yes.
I didn't know that.
You, not you.
But people got to, okay. Has it said that in any of the press? Publicity?
That's our policy. We don't want people
getting sick. But has it said that in any of the
This is a breaking news story. In the dumpster.
They're going to have to wear masks.
Yeah, we'll have them.
Oh, you'll have them there.
If they don't have their own, we'll give them one.
All right.
Yeah, we just want everybody to be safe.
The laughs will be muted, but they'll be there.
No. I got a mask on right now. You can hear me.
I know.
I'm laughing harder for her to fill in if it is being muted. And you're not going to spend the night at the Grange Hall to be fresh for Sunday's show, right? You will head back up to Elmore Mountain?
I'll head back to Elmore Mountain Saturday night. But Sunday after the show,
literally
after the show, wrap up, put my guitar in the car. I got to drive down to Marlboro where I'm shooting my last day on the Jay Craven film.
Tell us about this.
Well, real quick, I don't want to use it. Craven's doing a movie called Lost Nation. It's about the Ethan Allen story, not so much about Ethan Allen only or the fighting, but about the land grab that Ethan and the boys tried to do after off the Yorkers and the Massachusetts. The Indians are involved. There's some African-American people in that. So I'm going down there today at 1 to shoot a day. Tonight, come back after I shoot 3-4 in the morning here Friday, prepare more for the show, and then Saturday. Then Sunday, drive back down for my last day on Monday on that shoot. And that'll be out June 2023.
Are you playing Ethan or Ira or my favorite Seth Warner or?
No, Seth. There's John Noyes is a character.
Oh,
in
no
it.
Kidding.
Thomas Chittenden. He was a politician. Yeah. And I'm John Noyes' right hand man. I'm more of a henchman. Go figure. And his name's Asa Locke, which was a Massachusetts family, the Locke homestead you can visit and everything. Asalocke.
Okay.
I get to flog a pastor and everything, which we can do at the Grange Saturday and Sunday too. Any
not advisable. People are going to be wearing masks. I'm not sure you should do that. Might want to skip. Does Rusty include anything outlandish in the rider that you do for the show, that he's doing for the show there?
Outlandish.
Like, you know, all green M&Ms or, you know, any of the crazy things.
If it's legal, you can do it at the Grange. Okay.
No, for me, like when – so I'm the easiest. Whenever somebody hires me, I'm like,
rider,
I don't want any food.
Yeah.
I don't want any lodging. No. They're like, oh, we have a nice green room. I say, if you get food for me, it will be there when I leave. I'm not coming to your theater to eat. That's my job. So no rider, man.
No.
Okay.
He is so easy. He comes in, he does his thing, everybody leaves happy.
Oh, that's good. That's what we like to hear. Yep. All right, happening this Saturday and Sunday. Now, in addition to the movie you're making right now with Jay, you've worked with him before, I believe, on Windy Acres.
Windy Acres was a TV show that he did.
But
I've worked with Jay, and I have done 10 things together.
Yeah.
First time we worked together was he produced Judavine, the David Budd built Catamount Arts. That was 1985, so we've been working since 1985 together. Good friends. Yeah.
What's he like to work with?
I like him a lot. He's really you've done stuff with Jay.
Yeah.
Monica. He's just I like his directing style. I like that. Here's in a nutshell. Anytime I've worked with Jay over the years, and all these pictures and even other things that weren't moving pictures, I watch him, and before he touches base talking to every person on the crew, the PA parking the cars, sooner or later he's just down there chatting with them. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I like that. You know who else did that when I worked with him? Bill Cosby. I worked with him in a courtroom scene, and he was producing the show, TV show. It's called The Cosby Mysteries. And I watched him. This was years ago. Mm-hmm. And he went around to the last extra sitting in the – and then he just made them feel comfortable.
Yeah,
you know? So Jay does that too. And you don't always find that.
Yeah. Wow, that's really interesting. Now that you've broken the seal, you've opened up the Grange, you got Rusty this weekend, have you started to schedule other things? Or?
Yeah, actually, the first weekend in May, we have a show that's being directed by Teresa Langston, who's from this area. She's done a lot of theater up here, and she's directed a show in New Britain, Connecticut. And they're bringing it up. It's A Number by Carol Churchill. It's a fascinating play, very suspenseful. It's just a dynamite piece of work. And then we've got other things that I probably shouldn't talk about. We haven't locked in.
Okay.
But music and art and then there's family stuff that's coming in, and there's lots of different art workshops and music and all sorts of things.
Is there a website or Facebook page people can go to?
GrangeHallCC.
Grangehallcc.com? Or, okay, grangehallcc.com.
Rick, I brought you some artisan coffee from another one of my sponsors. I had to pay for that. I don't get that free. That you're very much a person who enjoys great things.
I do. The Catamount blend. Very. Thank you.
Catamount. I got that one just because I know you like Vermont.
I do indeed. Yeah. How could you tell? Rusty, tell people again what they're going to see Saturday and Sunday night at the Grange Hall.
Dang near 2 hours. You ain't going to want to leave. Music and also a lot of speaking and talking stories. Crowd work with them. Very much like an old kitchen tonk of the old days when you sit around the piano with your uncles and aunts and somebody grab a fiddle and go and you tell stories and everybody would laugh. Everyone is one in the world, but especially in the Grange Hall Cultural Center this Saturday and Sunday at the Lager Show.
Is it going to be interactive at all? Can people shout out stuff to you?
They can shout out. Yes. But I also am going to have giveaways. A little trivia giveaways. It won't take much of the show, but yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic.
I think I'm going to buy some Woodard syrup and give some of that away.
From George?
I'll buy it from them at the store or something.
That's fantastic. All right, and Monica, let people know again, times, dates, and it's April, not
April,
August. But
April,
this Saturday and Sunday, you can say. And how people get tickets.
23rd and 24th, 7:30 each night. We probably are going to sell out, but we'll have a couple of tickets at the door.
Yeah.
But you can call us at 802-244-4168 or email at grangehallcc@gmail.com to reserve tickets. You got to show up 15 minutes before the curtain. Otherwise, we might sell your ticket.
Sevendaystickets.com, too. And I sit there. I'll be greeting you.
Yeah, seven days tickets are there. You've already paid for them.
I'll be dead drunk.
That's on Howard Ave, 317 Howard Ave. In Waterbury Center.
All right. Keeps him to this great Vermont artisan
and
coffee,
Lee.
Black coffee for him there that night to keep him perked up and sober. Monica Callen is the co-founder of the Grange Hall Cultural Center in Waterbury. That's where the lager, Rusty DeLeese,
free weed,
will be performing this Saturday and Sunday. Again, tickets, 7daystickets.com, or you can call 802-244-4168. Rusty, Monica, thanks for stopping in.
Pleasure.
See you later by now.
All right. We're going to take a break for a CBS News update, and then we'll be back to hear about St. Michael's College Fire and Rescue. Coming up today at 11, we've got Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre, followed by Midday News Service. That's up until Red Sox baseball at 12:35. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Did you know that Radio Vermont Group Digital Services can create videos, including drone footage? We've even won awards for our videos. If you'd like to learn more and see examples of our work, go to rvgdigital.com. Radio Vermont Group. We're more than just radio.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. When I moved into 40th and Allen and learned that St. Michael's College had its own fire and rescue with students staffing it, I thought, wow, this is pretty cool. Of course, I was about 40 years late in realizing that this was a thing. Imagine that over 50 years ago, St. Mike's started its own fire and rescue. We're going to learn more about that this morning. And joining me now with the 411 about what happens when you dial 911 is John Keating, the rescue chief at St. Michael's Fire and Rescue. John, thanks for being with us this morning.
Thanks for having me on, Rick.
You're welcome.
How are you?
I'm great. How about you?
Oh, doing well.
Good. Listeners, to ask John a question or to share a comment, you can call us at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. John, why and when did this fire and rescue unit get started at St. Mike's?
So it was founded in 1969 after, unfortunately, a St. Michael's College student died on an athletic field right up there at Fort Ethan Allen. And several members of the college community believe that his death might have been prevented by a quicker emergency service. At the time, there was only one ambulance, I believe, in the county, and that was coming out of Burlington. So it took some time to get there. So under the guidance of our founder, Donald Sutton, who was the dean of students at the time and the security director at the college, they began what essentially evolved into the fire and rescue department. Started off with an ambulance, and then about a year later, they realized that there was also a need to start a fire department as well.
Mm. how forward-thinking. Were there many other colleges with their own fire and rescue at that time?
There were not too many colleges with their own fire and rescue. In fact, there wasn't a whole lot of communities here in Vermont with their own ambulance service at the time when it started.
And how about today? Is this fairly common to have a school with its own fire and rescue?
To an extent, you can probably find some form of either an EMS club or like a cadet fire program on many college campuses across the country. The difference is most of those are clubs, and they're first response agencies. They pretty much only help out and supplement the community, what the community already has. It is pretty unique to have a fire and rescue department that services the community and acts as like a primary ambulance in the community. I believe we're one of 10 or 15 ambulances in the country associated with the college that transport, and we're one of the few that have our own fire department with us.
That is stunning. I love to hear that. Did you serve in fire and rescue when you were in college?
I did. I was a graduate of St. Michael's College in 2017, so I started with the program here in my fall semester, my freshman year, so that's fall of 13, and one way or another, I've been here ever since.
And what kind of training must students go through to be part of the fire brigade or in the rescue unit?
So we offer most of the training fully in-house. So within their first year in college, they get acclimated to the department, how we operate and function. Typically, they spend their first semester in college learning how we operate, learning how to safely, either be on a fire truck or an ambulance. And then in their second semester, they start getting able to ride on the trucks, and they start learning more on the hands experience. And then from there, depending on what side of the house you're on, gets your specialized training. Mm-hmm. So at the fire department, they can take class at the fire academy and get national certified as a firefighter one or a firefighter two. And then on the EMS side, they can either take an EMT class or an advanced EMT class, which gives them their national certifications as well.
John, what kind of time commitment is required of these students during a semester?
So typically we say that it's somewhere between 20 and 24 hours a week. A lot of that comes on nights and weekends where they can run like a longer 12-hour shift, hopefully get some sleep through the night, or on the weekends they also run 12-hour shifts. But they do run sporadically during the weekdays depending upon their class schedule. But they are students first. I'm sure the administrators over the college would love to hear me say that. They are students first, so they're not able to respond to any emergencies if they're within about a 2-hour window of a class or like a study session or a lab.
Oh, that's interesting. Now, do some stay in the summer? Is this it's the Sutton Station, named after the founder. Do some stay in the summer to serve on the unit?
Yes. So we're open 365, 24/7, 365. And most of the department actually stays during the summer to keep both the ambulance and the fire truck in service. And we do get a large majority of them that stay, and they'll get summer jobs up here in the area. And it's a unique opportunity for them because they get to stay here in Vermont, beautiful downtown Burlington, throughout the summers.
Oh, that's fabulous. Now, tell us about the Sutton Station. I think originally you were in a small garage just across the street from where I actually live, but now you're out on Route 15 with a beautifully appointed station. So tell us about what you have there.
So like you said, we when it started back in 69, we were running out of a converted gas station up on right in the 40th and Allen. And then over time, the fire department stayed in the gas station. The rescue actually moved down here to the main part of the college basically a converted garage that was built for us. And then in 2005, Fire and Rescue realized that there was a need to kind of come back under one roof and get a state-of-the-art building. So they launched a fundraising campaign. In 2005, it came to completion, and here it is at, like you said, right across the main entrance from the college on Route 15. Houses two fire trucks, two ambulances, and has some sleeping quarters upstairs and some rooms for the students to kind of relax. Has a kitchen, and also houses the college's public safety department as well on the first floor.
Well, living where I do, I feel very secure. As a matter of fact, I saw it again driving into work today and thought, oh, thank goodness, it's right there. Now, living in the Ford, I have a front row seat for when you are practicing with the hoses, for instance. How much of a learning curve is there to handle those with all that water pressure?
I would say there is a learning curve. I haven't quite picked it up yet. I'm pretty much staying over on the EMS side of the house, but in times of training I have dabbled in it, and it is a learning curve. But before they let you operate on your own, you know, you undergo probably about a year of training before they, you know, you finish all your checklists, and then you're able to kind of go operate on your own. So I'm sure that there's a learning curve, but they give you all the training that you need to get up to speed.
It is a great way to cool down, to walk by there in a on a hot summer day when they're spraying. Also, residents in the Fort, we kind of come unglued the first time that we see smoke billowing out of the old theater building and several fire trucks there. What is that exercise?
So we were fortunate enough for the last couple years to be able to use either the old theater up there or the old chapel as training buildings. And so we have a fog machine or a smoke machine per se that we can put into any building and basically what we refer to as smoke it out. So it simulates smoke conditions in a building, and the firefighters are able to go in there and try to navigate a building when they essentially can't see, you know, 5 feet in front of them.
Right.
Because if they do have a building on fire, the visibility is almost zero. Mm. So it kind of trains them in as close of a training environment that we can get without actually burning a building.
Yeah. What's great is in the morning, there's the building still standing, and it's all fine. And, students got trained, so it's perfect. Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Sengary. Last week, we met the Plainfield Fire Chief and also a volunteer fireman from West Burke who's collecting supplies for the firefighters in Ukraine. This morning, we're learning about St. Michael's College Fire and Rescue. With me is John Keating. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can give us a call at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. John, do alumni keep in touch, come back and check in on the station?
They do. We have a vast alumni network. And in fact, a lot of them were in town just a couple weekends ago for a large banquet that we held to celebrate our 50th anniversary of our department.
Oh, that is fantastic.
About 250 of them come back.
Wow. Why do students get involved in fire and rescue while they're in college?
It depends on the student. Some students want something to do, some community service to give back to their community while they're in college. Some students want to do it because they've been involved in like a cadet fire program or a junior firefighter program back at home, and this is the next step for them to continue that. And some of them want to do it as to gain experience and as a resume builder as they go off to apply for jobs after college, whether that be in the fire service or nursing, PA, or doctorate school. Mm.
What skills do they learn while they're there, while they're in their college years, that will help them through those 4 years?
Well, aside from the training that they receive on the job, they get a lot of professional skills, whether that be time management, public speaking, or just generally how to just act professional. Because sometimes, you know, kids are coming to college and they don't really know how to act in, you know, a professional setting in a professional world. And this being here gives them the skills to be able to do that.
Yeah, I would imagine that anytime you're called for fire or for rescue, you're on for, you know, that particular amount of time. So you really do learn to present yourself in a very professional manner. Mm-hmm. How many students do you tend to have in fire and in rescue in a normal semester?
Currently, we have 60 students on our department. About 40 of them are on the EMS side, and about 20 of them are firefighters.
And was that affected somewhat by the pandemic?
Our numbers did drop a little the last couple of years due to the pandemic, but they came back strong, and we have some of the highest numbers that we've had in a long time.
Boy, I love that in a school of a couple thousand, you do have 60 who step up and say, I want to be part of something like this. Let's head to Moortown and talk to Wade. Hi, Wade. Go right ahead.
Hi, how you doing? I was wondering if John Buchanan was involved in the rescue and fire.
The name again, Wade?
John Buchanan, who was grounds manager.
John, does that name sound familiar to you, John Keating?
It does. It does not. Does not sound familiar to me. But we have a vast network of over 650 alumni and plenty of other people that helped when they were friends, when they were employed here by the college and are friends of the department over the last 50 years.
Yeah, it has been going on for over 50 years now. So, Wade, I'm sure at some point he probably was. How is the department funded, John?
We are funded both through private donations and fundraisers, as well as through reimbursements from insurance companies for ambulance transports.
Wow. Now, I know at some fire stations, they sell the T-shirts to make money for station needs, like almost like petty cash. Do you do that as well?
From time to time, we do have different fundraisers, but there's not a standing merchandise sale per se.
Gotcha. So what type of fundraising would you do?
Most of the fundraising that we currently do, it's not for ourselves, but we during the month of May, which is coming up, it's Mental Health Awareness Month, and then the month of October for breast cancer, we sell different department shirts that have the colors of the month on them, and we raise money for, in May, it's the Code Green Foundation, which focuses on mental health for first responders, and in October, it's breast cancer awareness.
And can people go to your website, smfronline.org, to learn about those things?
They can, and we will be setting up a web store at some point.
But, oh, fantastic.
But they can definitely go there to learn more information about that or about the department in general.
All right. Now, you mentioned that you had, you know, the event to bring back to celebrate the 50th anniversary. But what were some of your students doing in Pittsburgh recently?
In Pittsburgh, every year there is a collegiate EMS foundation. So it's all the colleges that have some form of EMS organization. They all get together once a year at a conference that gives them an opportunity to network with all their peers from across the country. So it happens once a year. And so this year we sent down four of our students, and they participated in an advanced life support skills competition and actually won first place in that competition. So they brought home a nice big trophy all the way back from Pittsburgh.
Well done. And what kind of things will they learn during that conference?
The Collegiate Foundation brings in leading doctors and nurses from across the country, and they'll present different half-hour to hour-long lectures on whether it be trauma or different medical things that they could see in the real world once they leave college.
Now, another community event I think that you're getting involved in has to do with St. Baldrick's. So can you tell us what's going on there? I saw some head shaving going on.
Yeah. So one of our juniors who's on the rescue side, Katie Escobedo, she has been involved with the St. Baldrick's Foundation for the last couple of years now. And St. Baldrick's raises money for childhood cancer by having different volunteers shave their head. So Katie, who's also one of our varsity athletes here at the college, has put together a fundraiser here with both athletics and fire and rescue. Has got a couple of our members, including herself, to sign up to shave their heads. And all the proceeds that they raise go to the St. Baldrick's Foundation for Childhood Cancer.
Oh, that's fantastic. And with St. Mike's having this fire and rescue department, does that help, you know, with when a student is considering a college that might be the type of thing that tips them, you know, their decision in the direction of St. Mike's?
We sure hope it does. And we do hear from students from time to time saying that they came here because they heard about our program. We hope that it tips a lot of people to come to St. Mike's, but every year we get about five or six of them that do tell us that they came here for the program.
What was it that you enjoyed doing it while you were going to college?
It's a little cheesy, but getting the sense of having a second family here. When you join an organization like this, you kind of get 50 other brothers and sisters and all the alums that come back. It's great networking, and it feels like a second home.
And with a commitment of 20 to 24 hours a week, were you able to, you know, keep your studies up and you know, make friends on campus in addition to what you had there at the Sutton Station?
I absolutely was. I absolutely was. I did learn great time management while here. A couple freshman, sophomore year, definitely learned that kind of on the fly and then easily able to do it junior and senior.
Nice. Where are you from originally, John?
Wilmington, Massachusetts.
All right. Well, we're glad you're here and that you stayed. John Keating is the rescue chief at St. Michael's College Fire and Rescue. To learn more about them, you can visit SMFR, as in St. Mike's Fire and Rescue, smfronline.org. John, thank you so much for letting us know about the work of your crew, and thanks to all of them for what they're doing.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
All right. Have a great day.
You as well.
That is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint was directed this morning by Lee Cattell. And listeners, you can feel free to suggest guests or topics for the show by emailing vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. And you can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at wdevradio.com. The podcast is sponsored by the Warren Store, funky, friendly, and almost world famous. Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre is up next. Don't forget we've got Red Sox baseball starting at 12:35, first pitch 1:35 this afternoon. I'm Rick Singeri. I'll meet you back here tomorrow when we talk with Bob Ney and we talk with the first woman to run in the Boston Marathon, Bobby Gibb.